Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. Whew. Good luck if you make the Swifties mad. After Ticketmaster botched the rollout of Taylor Swift tickets for her latest tour, the company has been in an even hotter seat than they were years ago when Pearl Jam rallied their fans against the company. And with yesterday's announcement that Beyoncé tickets are going on sale soon, the spotlight will stay on. So, today, we try to unravel the mysteries of ticket prices as we talk with musicians and experts about how the live music business really works. Are superstars just too in demand? Does the Ticketmaster-led corporate conglomerate have too much control over the music industry? That's all coming up next, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Just when you think there's nothing that can bring together this polarized country, something goes wrong with the Taylor Swift tickets, and Ticketmaster gets hauled before the Senate again, where last week, Richard Blumenthal actually thanked the company's CEO.
Mr. Berchtold, I want to congratulate and thank you for an absolutely stunning achievement. You have brought together Republicans and Democrats in an absolutely unified cause.
If you, like me, had been dimly aware there was something going on with Ticketmaster, either in these last few weeks or as far back as 1992 when Pearl Jam feuded with the corporation, but you weren't quite sure what was going on, then this show is for you. We're going to look at the recent problems, survey the company's past, and try to understand why Ticketmaster has become an emblem for what's wrong with American capitalism. We've got musicians, a journalist, and an antitrust expert, of course. Joining us first, we've got Clyde Lawrence and Jordan Cohen, who are parts of the band Lawrence. Clyde Lawrence testified at the Senate Judiciary hearing on Ticketmaster and Live Nation's practices. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Clyde, let's start with you. I mean, you're a smaller band based on the East Coast. You've been touring since 2016. And, you know, you joke that you can only dream of the kinds of ticket sales that Taylor Swift gets. But at the same time, you kind of have some similar complaints.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I'm not 100% sure what Taylor Swift's exact complaints are.
You haven't been texting? Yeah.
No, I mean, I haven't been texting in the exact circumstances of her her ticket sales failing are somewhat, you know, in a lot of ways, tangential to a lot of the issues that we have with the live music industry. And it goes beyond just Live Nation. But if what you mean by that is that Taylor Swift and certainly her fans feels like there are issues that need to be corrected, that we're certainly aligned with.
Yeah, yeah. Jordan Cohen, you're the tour manager for the band Lawrence, as well as the tenor saxophonist. From your perspective, what goes wrong with Ticketmaster for you all? Like, what's the actual beef about?
Yeah, well, again, like as Clyde's kind of mentioning, if we're talking just about Ticketmaster, the main issues to us are just that, and us being the artist, is that the fees that they're setting are so outrageously high, which kind of inflates the cost of admission into a show, into a Lawrence show. So if we're setting our ticket price at $30 based on our calculations of what we think our show is worth and what we think our fans should pay, next thing you know, the show is maybe $40, $45. And now that's actually pricing out a lot of our fans. So by, you know, Ticketmaster kind of is taking a lot of control and setting what the end price of a ticket might be, of what a show might be. And mind you, that's for a relatively inexpensive show. Imagine we're selling tickets at what we think should be a $100 price point, but after the Ticketmaster fees, it could be $140, $150.
Yeah. And of course, the artist doesn't get any cent of that additional fee that Ticketmaster is adding on. And right. that's the case with, it goes beyond Ticketmaster. That's the case with all ticket companies add these fees on that.
Not only do we not get a cent of the actual money, but we have zero say in what that fee is going to be. And often don't even know what it's going to be until the show actually goes on sale and we log on to check, just like all of our fans do.
Got it. I mean, maybe you two can walk us through the economics of, like, you know, this is the pie, this ticket price. And then, you know, breaking it down into, like, what actually ends up dropping into, like, the band's bank account as, like, profit, you know, or yep. whatever it is.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's, like, a great question that, frankly, not enough artists of all sizes can even, like, could even walk you through. I've asked that question when I was doing research for the New York Times op-ed that we wrote. And frankly, like, not enough artists can do that for their own tickets, but here's what it generally looks like for us. And I think a lot of other artists, if they were to look into their stuff. So let's say that we are charging a $30 ticket for our concert. That's the price that we choose to set. Ticketmaster will typically add a $12 ish. That's honestly on the lower end for them, service fee. So the fan is actually paying $42 for their ticket. That $12 off the top, we don't get a single cent of that. So that brings you down to $30 per ticket. The venue will then typically charge essentially a below the surface ticket fee to us, the artist. So like $3 of that $30, they will shave right off the top and call it what they call a facility fee, which is a similarly opaque fee. And so the actual, like, gross ticket price that we're basing the show's deal off of will start at like $27 out of the $42 that the fan spent. Then we have a deal with the venue that, you know, I could spend much longer than the time we have going into the specifics of the different types of deals that work. There are guarantees, there are profit sharing, there's all these different things. But generally speaking, after the cost of the show that the promoter, aka Live Nation's costs are covered, which is, those are typically recouped before the profit is shared. We will end up with maybe about, let's say, $12 to $15 of that $27, aka the original $42, but that's still before our costs are covered. So things like our travel, accommodations, tour bus, our touring crew that we travel with, even just like basic business operation costs, like insurance and other types of basic overhead. You know, there's a litany, obviously, of costs. It's both like a touring band and a small business. And so once all those things are covered in our case, because we take a lot of pride in being like really efficient while putting on a great show, we'll end up with maybe about $6 out of that ticket that people spent $42 on, and a lot of other bands of all sizes, much smaller than us and much bigger than us, will tell you that they end up with even less or none at all. You know, wow.
So yeah, I mean, just to summarize for folks, you know, the ticket price that someone actually, the amount charged to someone's credit card, is going to be $42. Then there's going to be a variety of fees that go to this conglomerate that is, you know, we call Ticketmaster Live Nation. That's going to be, you know, the ticketing service and the promoter and the venue and these different things with these kind of complex deals. And as you kind of you whittle down that money, at the end, you're going to get to about $6 dropping into your bank account, which is about 15% of what a fan would have paid. So that, to me, that feels like the core of the issue for you all is just like, you're asking fans to pay X, but you're only getting 15% of X to actually, you know, do all the things that then you need to, because you need to go record more music and you need to, you know, be a band and pay people salaries and all those things.
Yeah. And to be clear, like a lot of that money is going towards, you know, costs that just are costs. You know, plenty of the money is not going into the pocket of some combination of the venue, promoter, and ticketing company, all of which are one entity. Like, you know, I want to make that clear. There are plenty of legitimate costs that they have from their staff and all of their overhead costs, plenty of costs that we have that actually take you know, putting on a show. And we truly believe that Live Nation 100% deserves to make a great profit on the show, just like we do. But yes, ultimately we feel that some changes can be made to make it not $6 out of 42.
Yeah. Let's bring in another guest. Let's bring in August Brown, who's a staff writer for the LA Times. He wrote the recent article, "Everyone Hates Ticketmaster. Is Everyone Wrong?" Welcome, August.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So as you've been listening to Clyde Lawrence and Jordan Cohen of the band Lawrence talk about these issues, does this reflect what you see as happening in the, you know, generally speaking, for musicians out there?
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed their Senate testimony back at the hearing, and I thought it was really elucidating to see what kind of working musicians are up against today. And, you know, I think I'm not here to defend Ticketmaster per se, but I think their testimony makes a great argument that probably concerts should be even more expensive than they are actually, because, you know, they do get such a slim slice of the pie. And when you break it down as the way they just did, it illustrates how many other people in the ecosystem are making money except the people that you're actually there to see. And, you know, in decades past, up until about like the 2000s into the 2010s, you know, artists could make a lot more money on recorded music. And the expectation was that touring was kind of an advertisement for your album. And as things like first Napster and then Spotify, you know, kind of squeezed all but the elite tier out of being able to make a living on their records, you know, touring has become this really the only place that artists could make a decent living now. And especially given the last few years of, you know, inflation and kind of especially having to bounce back from the pandemic, you know, I think artists have become very cognizant of how thin these margins are right now because there's nowhere else to make it up. And when you look around to see who's going to absorb the blame of that, you know, this big multinational corporation that's slapping on these 30, 40% fees without kind of clear explanation as to where that money is going and why, it makes them a really easy target. I think fans and artists and a lot of people paying to go to concerts are rightly extremely frustrated by this. But the story as to like why these fees arose and where they're going and the measures that it would take to correct them will also have some additional consequences that, like, unfortunately, like any other way to solve a lot of these problems will also likely result in even higher fees for fans. And I think it's in everyone's interest to kind of understand, like, here's what bands are up against and what, you know, going to a concert should probably actually cost to make everyone have a sustainable living.
Yeah. We're talking about why everyone, or at least a lot of people, hate Ticketmaster, which is a subsidiary of Live Nation Entertainment. Leading us off, we've been lucky enough to be joined by Clyde Lawrence, co-founder of the band Lawrence, who testified at the January 24th Senate Judiciary hearing on Ticketmaster and Live Nation practices. Thanks for joining us, Clyde.
Happy to be here.
Yeah. And we've also been joined by Jordan Cohen, who's the tour manager and tenor saxophonist for the band Lawrence as well. Thanks for joining us, Jordan.
Of course, thank you.
Yeah. We're also joined by August Brown, who's going to stick with us after the break. He's a staff writer for the LA Times, who wrote the recent article, "Everyone Hates Ticketmaster. Is Everyone Wrong?" We're going to talk a lot more about this after the break, but we'd love to hear from you. You know, have you been priced out of seeing your favorite bands in concert or sports teams? You should get in touch with us. You know, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. It's KQED Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for more right after the break.
At Star One Credit Union, they're all about building long-term relationships and helping your money grow by making banking effortlessly easy. It's why they offer real great rates on home, auto, and solar loans. Star One provides super simple, everyday banking solutions, including a stellar digital banking experience that puts you first. Become a member at StarOne.org or drop by any of their Bay Area locations. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest. It's me.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. That's Anti-Hero by Taylor Swift that you're hearing. It was the ticket debacle at the end of last year that brought Ticketmaster back into the headlines, and they've been staying there for a variety of reasons, including a Senate Judiciary hearing last week. We are joined this morning by August Brown, staff writer for the LA Times, who wrote the recent article, "Everyone Hates Ticketmaster. Is Everyone Wrong?" And I guess that hearing, if you're looking it up on C-SPAN, which I'm sure you all are, is January 24th, which was just before last week. Want to bring in another guest, Diana Moss, president of the American Antitrust Institute. Welcome, Diana.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And, of course, we would like to hear from you as well. Have you been priced out of seeing your favorite bands in concert or sports teams? One listener wrote in to say, "In 1987, I bought tickets to see U2 at the Cow Palace. I still have this ticket, and the price was $18.75. Making tickets so expensive comes at the expense of musical culture, making concert going a rare night out for most." You can give us a call to share your stories. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. One perspective we're really interested in is venue operators. Is your ability to book acts and bring revenue impacted by Live Nation? You can give us a call at that number or Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or KQED Forum. And the email is forum@kqed.org. Diana, we were hoping that you could give us a little pocket history here of how Ticketmaster, Live Nation, and this other set of companies that have been kind of snatched up by the same conglomerate, how they all came to roll up and what sort of are the rules of that conglomerate?
Yeah, I think that backstory is really important to what we have been seeing in terms of harmful competitive effects and harm to consumers and artists and smaller businesses in the live entertainment supply chain. So it really all started in 2010 when Live Nation, you know, big concert promoter and venue manager, proposed to merge with Ticketmaster, which even then in 2010 had about an 80% market share. So What that merger did, we call it a vertical merger, was put together an entire supply chain, which covers, you know, the wingspan of the company is enormous. It covers everything from artist management to promotion to venues to primary ticketing and now into secondary ticketing. So when you have companies with enormous market shares along most of those levels and you put them together, it creates just supercharged incentives for the company to ice out smaller rivals, like smaller promoters, smaller venues that don't affiliate, and also to squeeze out the secondary market, make it more difficult for that to operate efficiently. And that's exactly what we've seen. And, you know, the hallmark of a big monopoly like this is that there's no choice. There's no choice for artists, and there's no choice for consumers.
Yeah. You know, I feel like you're also describing a little bit of an emergent strain of antitrust thinking, which says that these kinds of companies, even if you couldn't prove they were a monopoly by some technical definition, has so much concentrated market power that they have a variety of effects that are bad for marketplaces, for producers, for consumers. It's not just right about the ticket price, although that may be an indication of some problems, but it's this broader set of powers that a company like that can exert in some kind of marketplace.
Absolutely. And, you know, we are seeing the resurgence of the monopoly problem in the United States. You know, we've had pretty lax antitrust enforcement over the last 40 years. And we've seen monopolies pop up all over. We have them in agricultural biotech. We have them in live events. We see them in digital tech with the platforms, but you know, we're also seeing the emergence of what we call these oligopolies, where you just have two, maybe three firms competing. None of that is good for competition. I mean, the incentives are not to compete. The incentives are to limit competition from smaller innovative rivals, smaller players, and everyone suffers from that. So yeah, it is part and parcel of a bigger monopoly problem in America.
What other bit of history before we turn back to August Brown? There, when Ticketmaster and Live Nation were allowed to merge, because a merger like this was subject to some kind of governmental approval, they entered into a consent decree, like basically a set of rules that they would choose to operate by going forward. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because it feels like that's the sort of thing that should constrain some of these anti-competitive behaviors that you're talking about.
Sure. So, you know, in a vertical merger, the gestalt has been for years that, wow, you know, you put different businesses together into a supply chain under a single ownership. Wow, that's got to really generate some benefits for consumers, you know, better coordination, better, more innovation, high quality products. And so antitrust enforcers have gone really easy on those kinds of vertical mergers. And instead of either moving to block them by going to federal court to get an injunction, instead of requiring divestitures or spinoffs, which would mm-hmm. reduce the market power of the company, they
We're talking about breaking them up. Yeah,
exactly. And that's not what DOJ did. In fact, you know, they should have blocked it, or they should have found a way to reduce this incredible market power the firm would have. Instead, they held them to a bunch of rules and requirements that would prevent them from discriminating against rivals and retaliating against venues and a whole list. Well, you know, we know those don't work. Those types of remedies don't work because you haven't changed the incentive for the company to exercise its market power by one iota. All you've said is you can continue to operate as a powerful company, but you have to comply with these requirements. And in 2020, when the DOJ reopened the consent order, they had six venues on record anonymously saying they had been threatened if they didn't take the Ticketmaster platform along with the other services. So yeah, a real failure of antitrust enforcement.
Yeah. You know, August Brown, you know, in your piece, one of the things that's pretty fascinating about it is the way that you kind of go try and look at, okay, this, I hear these criticisms from fans and musicians, but sort of what are the alternatives to Ticketmaster? And can you kind of walk us through that reporting process and kind of what conclusions you came to?
Yeah, I think it's important to know that the kind of the skeleton key to all of this is that Ticketmaster is not in the business of selling tickets to fans per se. Like, you are not their main client. What they do is they pay advances out to venues, most specifically and promoters, for the right to be able to sell tickets to events. And competition normally would open up a lot of room to kind of undercut some of those costs. Like, if Ticketmaster's charging a $20 fee and someone can, you know, figure out a way to make it work for $15, that ordinarily would be, you know, the way that they could bring prices down. And historically, you know, that's been, you know, when you're looking at kind of antitrust concerns, you know, if you're driving down prices for consumers, they take a much kind of longer leash with that kind of a thing. But the problem is that if a competitor to Ticketmaster wants to win the right to sell tickets to things, the way they'll get that concert is by bidding up the advances. So more companies kind of like bidding out for like a Taylor Swift tour, you know, at the highest end or even like middle tier tours, means like an advance that would be $100,000 for a show goes up to $125,000, $150,000. And, you know, so this is a rare case for introducing more competition. You know, while I think it's good, I think Live Nation and Ticketmaster has incredibly outsized power for a variety of reasons. You know, this is one instance where like more competition isn't necessarily going to inherently drive prices down. And if there are a lot of reasons why this is a very kind of unhealthy oligopoly, and like, you know, that this company needs to have more competition just to have a fairer play, to, you know, not have one firm running all aspects of the live music industry. But it depends on the kind of problem that you want to solve. If the problem is just that you feel like tickets are too expensive, competition isn't necessarily going to be the silver bullet that fixes it. But, you know, hearing from Lawrence and hearing from a lot of other venues and hearing in my own reporting, you know, one thing that comes up a lot is that there is, within the consent decree, there is supposed to be a wall between Live Nation and Ticketmaster, that if you want to go with Live Nation as a promoter but use a different ticketer, they're not supposed to be able to retaliate against you. And if you want to use Ticketmaster but you're a different promoter, you know, that should be able to be fine. You should be able to use Ticketmaster like a utility almost. But the thing that kept coming up a lot in my reporting is that Live Nation always seems to know when Ticketmaster is going with someone else, and they can kind of outbid them for the same show. Or if you want to go with Live Nation and not Ticketmaster, Live Nation will kind of hesitate to bring their best shows to you because you're not using the full package. And that's the kind of thing that I think antitrust regulators will take a really acute interest in, because that's the kind of thing the consent decree is supposed to specifically prohibit. And they just keep winding up in the crosshairs for violating that over the years.
Yeah. You know, Diana Moss, it makes sense to me that even if there were a piece of paper that says, by the way, don't do this, that people who are making sales and cutting deals wouldn't have to look at the paper and say, hey, buddy, you really should use Ticketmaster if you wanted this show, but that it would be understood that they should go with that bigger company. How do you try and study or show that that kind of thing is going on when almost by definition, it doesn't have to be written down on a piece of paper like we're doing this thing that's against the consent decree? We can just kind of wink and nod and, you know, go out for a beer.
Right. And that's exactly what we see happen in markets that are dominated by monopolies. It's really just the threat. It's the threat of being retaliated against that is enough to keep everybody in line. It keeps everybody going to Live Nation for promotion and venue services. It keeps everyone going to Ticketmaster. So when companies get big enough, it really, the concern really just translates to the threat of, as opposed to actual abusive action taken against smaller rivals. And you know, when you know that, you know you have a real monopoly problem on your hands. And I think the only response to that from a policy standpoint is to break up the company, which then removes all of those incentives to threaten, to harass, to retaliate if not everybody stays inside the Live Nation Ticketmaster system. Because that's the MO. It's to keep everybody locked in the Live Nation Ticketmaster system so that there's very little competitive threat from the outside.
And just before we get to listeners, I just want to note too, right, that breakups became very rare, right? It kind of 1980 onward, right? I mean, they were a piece of antitrust enforcement that sort of fell out of the government toolkit.
Yes. So monopolization law in the United States is the least enforced area of the law. And our last big monopolization case that led to a breakup, of course, was AT&T in 1984. And that's how we got the baby bells. And that's how we got a lot of innovation in the telephone industry. So it is not a common thing to see breakups. It's time that enforcers got that off the shelf and dusted it off, because there would be no better example of a way to restore competition with a breakup and serve the interests of artists and creativity and innovation and consumers who really want to go see their musicians and support them. There would be no better case than this one at hand right now.
Let's bring in some callers. Preston in San Francisco, welcome.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. This is a really interesting conversation because I try and see about 30 to 50 shows a year with a set of friends, and we've been doing that for years. I have two comments. You know, on the last comment about alternatives, I really like, and I do this going down to like the Independent or the Chapel box office and buying a ticket from a knowledgeable music fan in person and only being charged a dollar service charge. You know, it's a good conversation, a good connection. But back to Ticketmaster, I think the thing they've really got wrong in saying they're trying to make it better for the fans over the past few years is changing the user interface and making it so complicated to select the seat that with all the pre-sales and the platinum packages, by the time you get to choose a seat, you don't know whether you're buying the $100 ticket or the $300 ticket or the $500 ticket, and you lose those minutes, the seconds, and then it just keeps getting harder and harder to find it every minute you lose.
That's a really interesting point, Preston. I wanted to bring this one to you, August Brown, because this strikes me as one of those things where maybe Ticketmaster is offering those things because the artists want to offer those things, right? And they're just kind of executing the will of the artist, no?
Yeah, I mean, when there's very little that happens on a ticket on sale that the artist isn't aware of or approve of. And it's funny that they bring this up specifically in the context of the Taylor Swift debacle. I spoke to several very high-ranking like concert and ticketing industry executives who said they think that's why the system collapsed, is because they allowed fans to pick individual seats at various price points. And that created a lot of bottleneck of people all trying to select the same seats and a big kind of pile on. And that's what crashed the software. Whereas there's a switch you could flip where you just like pick your price point and you get allocated the best available seat in that price point. And that could have smoothed over some of the selection process. So I think the caller has a really good point that especially for really high volume, high demand stadium shows that sell out in a matter of seconds, you know, that kind of complicated interface of having so many options to pick your own seats is what caused a lot of the software to explode on the back end for Taylor Swift, at least.
You know, another listener writes in to say, I tried to get Blackpink tickets to take my 10-year-old daughter to see her favorite band. Not only did I have to pay $25 to become a member of their fan club to get early bird access to buy tickets, but I watched the same seat prices go from $80 to $500 within hours. Surge pricing made it unaffordable. Millie also tweets, in addition to the ridiculous fees, Ticketmaster's most egregious practice is the platinum price tickets. Real fans struggle to purchase face value tickets when Ticketmaster itself is up-pricing tickets to a market value alongside scalpers. And I want to bring in George, just because I do want to talk about this secondary market, though we may have to do it after the break. Welcome, George.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. The issue I wanted to bring up is this whole issue of the secondary market. Now, Ticketmaster has the primary market, and they also have Tickets Now, which is their secondary market. And for years, Ticketmaster has been complaining that when tickets are scooped up early, it's usually brokers or these bots. And the reality is it's in Ticketmaster's interest to have these tickets sold to brokers or bots so they could double dip. They not only earn outrageous fees when they sell in the primary market, but then they earn additional fees when they put them back on their secondary market. And I think that's really outrageous to do so.
George, it's a really interesting point. And, you know, Diana Moss, this feels like another place where because Ticketmaster has another horse in the race, they even if it's to their benefit to put the thumb on the scale in some ways.
It is. You know, I think it's important to remember that before Ticketmaster went into secondary ticketing, right, it had very strong incentives to drive everybody to the primary ticketing market to keep complete control over the ticketing process, where it could really exercise its market power in fees. You know, ticket face value of tickets is a different story entirely, but the real monopoly power comes in the high fees. When they went into secondary ticketing and bought up, you know, developed their own stake in the secondary market, they had even more incentives to sort of squeeze out secondary market sellers, the resellers, the ticket brokers. And they've done this through a really concerted set of mechanisms, you know, that impede ticket transferability. There are the revolving barcodes, there are the ticket holdbacks. They have, like any monopolist, come up with this strategy to absolutely protect their monopoly and to keep competition at bay.
Yeah. We're talking about Ticketmaster, of course. We're joined by Diana Moss, president of the American Antitrust Institute, and August Brown, staff writer for the LA Times. Stay with us. We're going to talk with Deerhoof after the break.
Star One Credit Union provides you with the tech, tools, and terms to control your money and your lifestyle. Simple, seamless, everyday financial services and solutions. Online and mobile banking backed by the latest technology. Great rates on home, auto, and solar loans. And real people providing real assistance when you need it. At Star One, they always put you first. Become a member at staronecredit.org or visit any of their Bay Area locations. Star One Credit Union. In your best interest.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. That is your Dystopic Creation Doesn't Fear You by Deerhoof. And we are joined by Greg Sonnier from Deerhoof, joining our conversation about Ticketmaster. Welcome, Greg.
Hi, how are you doing?
Yeah, doing well. We're also joined this hour by August Brown, staff writer for the LA Times, who wrote the recent article, Everyone Hates Ticketmaster, Is Everyone Wrong? And Diana Moss, president of the American Antitrust Institute. And earlier, we were joined by a couple members of the band Lawrence. Greg, so what's the best way for your fans to see you live and for you to make the most money?
What we usually do is we play at venues that don't use Ticketmaster, and we're always happy when we have that option. And then, like, I think it was Preston or somebody, one of the callers came in and said, and you might end up with a $1 service charge from the venue when you walk up to the ticket booth and buy the ticket. But in some cities, we have no choice. And that has to do with the monopoly that's been discussed. There aren't an infinity number of venues in every city that a band might want to play on tour in the U.S. They're an appropriately sized venue. There might only be one or two. And if it happens to be a Live Nation / Ticketmaster venue, then that's what you have to do, unless you just want to skip, you know, playing music for all your fans in that city.
And, like, you know, how is it different for you in a, you know, Ticketmaster Live Nation show versus, you know, when you're able to not do that?
Just that people who make what would be considered an average income cannot afford to come to the show. Our shows are cheaper than the Lawrence. You know, we usually have our tickets set at 20 or less, depending on the city. But if it gets too much, then people don't go. I feel that, you know, a couple things, I've really been enjoying the conversation so far, but a couple things that I think have been missing is just to point out that while Live Nation and Ticketmaster bill themselves as somehow music related companies, what it is a finance company. And when we're talking about innovations, we're talking about financial innovations. That's it. They should be thought of as a finance company, and by that I mean, you know, they're in the business of innovating new surcharges that do not correspond to any added value for the band, for the fans, or for the staff of the venue. The staff of the venue is another party that we've been leaving out of this conversation. Their wages have stagnated under the new the sort of dictatorship of the Live Nation Ticketmaster monopoly. I completely agree that it should have been broken up. I saw yesterday Biden announced something called the Junk Fee Protection Act that I was very disappointed to see, but didn't surprise me, because it was a way to make it appear as though he is doing something by, in essence, if I understand it correctly, and somebody can help me out if I'm interpreting it incorrectly, is that Ticketmaster will, if passed, will no longer be able to hide their surcharge and save it till later when it's checkout time. This doesn't mean that they won't be able to still have the surcharge. It just means that a very incredibly minor tinkering, with the presentation that, frankly, it's sort of like Biden is trying to give a helping hand to that monopoly, saying, hey, you guys, you're embarrassing yourselves. You're making fools of yourselves in public. Here's a little hint. Don't be so egregiously obvious about it. We're totally thumbs up about the fact that you have this monopoly. Here's a way to make it easier for you to retain it. And I would go beyond monopoly. I'm surprised the word conflict of interest has not come up in this conversation, because normally a promoter / venue versus a ticketing agency, those would be adversaries in any normal relationship. And then a ticketing agency versus a secondary market, those would be adversaries in any normal arrangement. If you own all three, if you're in control of all three, and especially if your market share of all three is, you know, over 80%, then then you have a monopoly combined with a conflict of interest, which is, you know, surprise, surprise, a recipe for exactly what we see that yes, everyone hates.
Yeah. Wow. Greg Saunier from Deerhoof. That was magisterial. Thank you so much for joining us and providing
King
that
Greg,
perspective.
King Greg, you got to call me. Yeah.
Yes, King Greg. Thank you. That was amazing. I really appreciate that perspective. I wanted to go to Diana Moss on the Biden Act, the Junk Fees Act that Greg referenced.
Yeah, so we did see this sort of amendment to the original Biden order pushing out new thinking and new initiatives yesterday. You know, junk fees are pervasive. It's not just in live entertainment, but we see it in airlines. You know, we see it in other sectors. And one thing about junk fees is that we typically see them when we're in markets where there's a lot of market power. I think about airlines, right? We've seen a substantial loss of competition in the domestic airline industry over the last many years. And guess what? Bag fees have gone up and pick your seat fees have gone up. So that's a function of more market power and the ability of the companies to impose higher fees on consumers. And of course, you know, we see it in live entertainment with these fees that can exceed 40% of the face value of the ticket. Part of the problem, though, is that when you have a digital ecosystem like Ticketmaster is, it's just a big digital platform at this point, you know, you get the consumer in, you lock them in through a variety of mechanisms, and then you put them in line, and then you sell them a ticket. And then by the end of the whole search process, which is long and tiring, the consumer is completely worn out. They have no incentive to do anything but click purchase. And then, you know, they've paid the 40% ticket fees. If there was more competition in primary ticketing, I guarantee you fees would drop precipitously. That would be one of the very first indicators of the effectiveness of a breakup remedy. If there was more competition in ticketing, but also in all the other parts of the supply chain that Live Nation dominates.
Yeah. Want to get to some user comments and back to the phones. One listener writes in to say, I just tried to get tickets to the Madonna show. With every seat I chose, I was continuously told another buyer was ahead of me on their app. Eventually, I gave up as I watched all the seats I could barely afford get snatched up. It made me yearn for the past when we lined up outside of Tower Records on Telegraph at 5 a.m. or even spent the night in a chair waiting for the ticket booth to open. Robert writes in to say, there is a legislation recently introduced in the California State Legislature, Assembly Bill 8, authored by Assemblymember Laura Friedman, that would begin to take on the issue of the lack of price transparency and all the, quote, junk fees that are attached to tickets. I'd also just note that some of those junk fees are generated by the user interfaces that people use, because you end up sorting by low price and people figure out how to get that number down. Let's go to Wayne in Fairfield.
Hi, thanks for having me on. This is obviously a complicated issue for a lot of folks, you know, in terms of why prices have increased, et cetera. But one issue that comes up that I think is inexcusable is dynamic pricing that Ticketmaster uses, essentially treating the tickets that you want to buy like the stock market, where sometimes they go up and sometimes they go down. And, you know, a good example of that is my wife and I on vacation. We're on the East Coast back in, I think it was October, and we wanted to buy tickets to go see Bruce Springsteen. And the tickets were outrageously priced. The prices that we were looking at just for two tickets, we could easily spend $8,000 at Ticketmaster, not a secondary market, just for two tickets. And the dynamic pricing of that is such that it never benefits the customer. It always benefits Ticketmaster.
Bruce Springsteen.
I don't know if Bruce benefits from it also. You know, some of them do. Maybe they do. I don't know. But either way, if they agree to do the dynamic pricing, what ends up happening is because they have their secondary vendors that they themselves own, the demand for that never goes down. So in other words, it's a rigged system because they are buying a whole bunch of block of tickets for their secondary market, which escalates the demand and increases the prices that are associated with it. And it's highway robbery. Yeah. I mean, honestly, I went to 12 concerts last year, 12. And all of them combined, I probably spent maybe about $1,000, okay, maybe $2,000 at the most. And these were bands that really deserved, you know, my money because they're smaller bands, et cetera. And what this does is it, I think, essentially, Bruce Springsteen at the end of the day doesn't care about whether or not I'm paying $8,000 for two tickets. But if you want to make this available to all of your fans fairly, then you should care. Mm-hmm. And Ticketmaster elected to put the dynamic pricing into place. It was their choice to put it in place. Whether or not an artist agrees to it, I don't know. But if they do, shame on them as well, because it is highway robbery.
Yeah.
So that's
yeah.
just my comment on it, and I'd like to see a solution to that.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, Wayne. I mean, August, got to come to you on this, because I feel like you made a very good point in your article, which is the artists are going to make more money if they sell every ticket for $4,000 instead of $400, right? But it's Ticketmaster who takes the heat for it.
Yeah, that's how Ticketmaster was designed. And like, I'm a huge Bruce Springsteen fan. I would love to see him on Broadway. But to the caller's point, you got to be mad at Bruce on this one. This was 100% his and John Landau, his manager's decision about all of this, because the sad, you know, I'm frustrated by this too. It's just there are a ton of people that want to see Bruce on Broadway, and much more than there are seats in the arena. And that balloon's got to get squeezed at some point. And, you know, when it comes to dynamic pricing, that is 100% an artist decision to do that. Ticketmaster does not force that on anybody. And it's done because, you know, artists get really frustrated when, you know, they see tickets going for the, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 on the secondary market when they're only charging a few hundred for it. And I think rightly, you know, if someone's going to be paying that much for a ticket, it should probably be Bruce Springsteen's profit as opposed to someone like StubHub's. And so dynamic pricing, you know, it only really kind of kicks, it only is like a good proposition when you're dealing with this like thin band of extremely hot ticket shows that mm-hmm. there's just no way to accommodate demand without having outrageous prices. And, you know, I'd rather pay that money to Bruce than to a secondary market broker. But yeah, like, sadly, like the probably appropriate cost to see Bruce Springsteen do his Broadway show in a theater is probably, I hate to say it, it's probably somewhere in the realm of a few thousand dollars. And, you know, Bruce has played, like, he's commented that effect, that he's underpriced his shows for most of his career in a very populist gesture. But, you know, there's just kind of no way to make the math work without like a secondary market coming up and being outrageously expensive, other than to do something to make tickets more expensive right at the gate. And, you know, and I'm frustrated by that too. If I'm a fan who just wants to see an artist I grew up loving, and I see prices or, you know, the cost of a month traveling in Europe, you know, that seems insane. Like I wouldn't understand that. You know, and unfortunately with this particular instance, you gotta be mad at the boss on that one. That was his call.
Well, it's interesting too, because right, I mean, there's a freight rock star economics to kind of describe this, these sort of economic systems where, you know, the rewards are really going to the top 1% or the top 0.1% of artists who can, you know, there's a lot more people who want to see them than there are tickets, and so they can essentially raise the price as high as they want and still have sold out shows. What do you, Greg Saunier, co-founder of the local band Deerhoof, when you hear, what were you thinking?
Well, dynamic pricing doesn't come into play with us, but you know, we're very, you know, medium, small sized band. But I do think that it is an example of an overall trend since the period began about 40 years ago that we've been talking about, mm-hmm. a general trend in the United States towards shifting it. When the caller was talking about it feels like playing the stock market, I think that that's true. I think it's true for fans, it's true for musicians, and it's true for venue owners and staff, that the risks involved have gradually and somewhat secretly been shifted to the individual, and the risks shifted away from the people that you would think under a free market economy should be bearing it, which would be the people with capital. Mm-hmm. But more and more, you know, it's part of a general trend, and music is no exception. And it's not only no exception, but I think it's in fact an exaggerated version of it, because the everything has been inflating. You know, there's been inflation for gas and milk, etc. The amount of inflation on fees, surcharges, penalties, interest, etc. Particularly when you're talking about Ticketmaster, the amount that they have inflated their inflation since that merger occurred is way beyond the rate of inflation in the general economy. And it's, you know, so that's obviously, it's
to their benefit.
Egregious example of this neoliberal transfer of the responsibility and the risk to the individual.
Yeah. Real quick, Diana Moss, president of the American Antitrust Institute. I wanted to, you know, come bouncing off of Greg's point, and Meredith writes in to say, we've been talking about the fees that Ticketmaster charges, but I'd also like to know how much profit Ticketmaster makes off of these fees. The ticket prices of bands I go see live have changed from about $75 to $150, with up to $50 of that as fees. I would like to know how much profit they report and how much of that fee is used for actual operations costs versus just straight up, you know, money in their pocket.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think we would all like to know that. But I, you know, again, even without running that down and doing those calculations, we know that the fees are going to be exorbitantly high because of the Live Nation Ticketmaster monopoly. They have every incentive and ability, because there's no choice for smaller artists, no choice for consumers, to deal with anyone outside of the monopoly. And so they will set those fees at a monopoly level, and they will split up those fees across the entire supply chain. You know, their venues that they have exclusives with, their proprietary concert promoters. And you know, interestingly, at the hearing, the Senate hearing, the Live Nation spokesperson said, well, we don't have any control over ticket fees. Which was just wrong. You know, that was not an accurate statement, at least in the context of that conversation. They have absolute control over the ticket fees. Again, face value ticket prices are very different. That's a whole different sort of mechanism. But I guarantee you, if we had, say, even three ticketing platforms duking it out, a head-to-head
things would be different.
We would see, we would see fees go down. That would be the first thing we'd see.
We've been talking about Ticketmaster and the high price of concert tickets with Diana Moss, president of the American Antitrust Institute, August Brown, staff writer for the LA Times, who wrote the recent very excellent article, which you should check out, Everyone Hates Ticketmaster, Is Everyone Wrong? We've also been joined by Greg Saunier, co-founder of the local band Deerhoof, and earlier we talked with Clyde Lawrence and Jordan Cohen of the band Lawrence. Thank you so much for all of your calls and comments. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of them. This is Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour ahead with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.